Speaker. Honourable members, it has been said that there is no cause which is lost if there is one fool who is willing to stand up and fight for it. There has been mountainous buildup of speculation as to the course of action I will take and the position I will adopt in relation to the estimates of expenditure presented here. Not to be rubber stamped here, but presented for the consideration of this Honorable House. Note I said consideration, because this is what each and every one of us in this House must do. We have to consider the estimates of expenditure. We have to consider its relevance, its value, its efficacy, its applicability. Is it what we need in this particular time? Because it's a blueprint. It is a blueprint as to how the government is thinking and where it intends to take this country. We are not here to support a budget because we are flabbos, or here to vote against a budget because we wear red shirts at a rally. We have to stand here as individual representatives of the people and decide whether or not what is contained within those estimates are relevant and beneficial to the people. I know ministers, they sometimes find themselves in a somewhat different position, because as ministers, you are normally expected to have had some input into how things go, and therefore no one would expect that you would go against a budget which you had something to do with preparing. But sometimes, Madam Speaker, truth is stranger than fiction. Madam Speaker, when I get back to the speculation aspect of this, I know that there are all sorts of thoughts going into the heads of the citizenry of this country. There was talk about defections, persons possibly crossing the floor, voting against the budget. None of that has happened so far. But I want to tell you, Madam Speaker, that I have no intention of crossing the floor. But if I did, unlike the member for Soufriere, who said he would cross the floor and commit suicide, I want to assure you that I would win my seat again with greater ease. That's the reality. Because Choiseul is, by and large, a Labour seat. At any time I talk about crossing the floor, I must not be presumptuous, but must also broach the possibility that I may not be accepted. Rest assured, though, that no government will fall today. But I do intend to make a contribution, and a valid contribution, based only on what's before me, and with no prejudice with regards to anybody or any political party. It is my right and my role as a backbencher in this Honorable House. There's no saying, Madam Speaker, that the man who speaks about the ills of a nation is the man who saves the life of that nation. There may be a life worth saving here today. Once again, Madam Speaker, the princely sum approaching $1.2 billion of the people's money, which we have the sacred duty to spend on behalf of and in the best interests of the people, is expected to become available during the course of this financial year. I am aware, in spite of all the efforts to suggest otherwise, that there are all sorts of agendas at play. There are groups and subgroups, lobbyists and loyalists, functionaries and parasites, hypocrites and backstabbers, pawns and profiteers, towerers and cowards. This is part of the drama which is unfolding today. But everyone is seeking a benefit, small, large, and in some cases exceedingly large, from the anticipated windfall in this budget. But as I will often repeat, beyond the usual handouts and what government is expected to do, what is in it for the average citizen? Clearly, Madam Speaker, this budget was designed to provide some kind of psychological stimulus, to give hope to a restless and increasingly agitated populace that this government was not sitting idly by, patching its roof over the last 16 months, but that big things, really big things, are just around the corner. Since many of our own supporters are feeling the pain and grumbling, quietly, I must add, can't make too much noise. Because, you know, if you're a good boy or a good girl and display loyalty no matter what, especially if you display that loyalty to the invisible managers, then you'll surely go and get your pound of flesh. But if you don't, the full power of the state may be unleashed against you, and you might find yourself having a name change from Bustay to Tucker. If you don't play by their rules, Madam Speaker, nothing for your constituents. I'm not saying I didn't get anything now, mind you. I'm saying nothing for your constituency, because there are different players, but there are some main players. And ministers sometimes have to be careful what they do. Can you believe this? Ministers, I don't know. Sometimes I get the impression people are going cup in hand to ask other people, you know, can I get this? Can you put this in the budget for me? Madam Speaker, there are insidious and dangerous forces at work in the back rooms of government. And they are not sitting on the opposition benches, neither are they sitting on the benches of the government side. Yet their DNA is all over this budgetary crime scene. And if you allow this budget to pass without comment or action, there will be 17 judgments against this house, one for every member who fails and sacrifices ethics and principles on the altar of expediency. Every member on this side of the house know what I'm talking about. And it's time for action. It is time that elected members, who themselves know little about what's going on within the deep confines of management, stand up and be counted. Stop taking the blame and being the cannon fodder, left here like willing sheep to be slaughtered by the opposition on matters you know little about. You have failed to take your rightful place as representatives of the people. You are just a number so that the job can get done. But not me. Not me. With all my faults, with all my pimples, with all my human frailties and deficiencies, when we look back in history, Rufus Bustay, the representative for Choiseul, would have stood up. He has paid the price, but he has stood up. That is going to be my legacy. The brunt of the opposition attacks, to my mind, seem to focus on two individuals in particular. Imagine that. Tourism, trade and industry, planning, economic planning, investment, economic affairs. These are critical issues to the country today. Critical! And yet there is no one sitting in this House to stand up and to be counted or to give account for these intrinsic and critical components of this government's operations. Not here to account to the people. Who will speak for them? The Prime Minister? Madam Speaker, I listened carefully to the Prime Minister as he presented his estimates of revenue and expenditure. I listened very, very carefully. There was a ring of karaoke about it. Because while he sang the song, deep down many felt it wasn't his music. I'm therefore tempted to call this the karaoke budget. But there are more important aspects of this presentation, or his presentation, which need to be highlighted. And so I will refrain from that characterization and will focus elsewhere for the time being. This should not be construed. What I just said there should not be construed as taking a personal dig at the Prime Minister or Mekwi or anything of that nature. But it must be taken within the context of the Prime Minister's own admission. When questioned recently by a journalist that there existed a perception that he was not in charge of his government, he is reported to have replied that it did not matter who is running the country as long as the work is being done. That's what was reported. You didn't hear me. So I'll say it again. It didn't matter who was running the country as long as the work was being done. What? It doesn't matter. It matters to members here, I'm sure. It matters to the people of St. Lucia. It matters to the voters, I'm sure. It matters to me. It especially matters to me because I put my signature to paper and sent a letter to the Governor General asking that this gentleman, Madam Speaker, a member for Castries North, assume the position of Prime Minister. I did that. And so it matters to me if it doesn't matter to him. But what work is it? Because he said work is being done. What work are we talking about here? I mean, no government does absolutely nothing. I listened to the reports from the ministers and so on. And they gave reports on their ministries and so on. I mean, you know, it was somewhat pedantic and so on. But at the end of the day, there was stuff coming. Guys are doing their thing. They're going to the office. Stuff is going on. If every minister here went on a plane and left the country, work would still be going on. What goes on? They start, they're so on. Ministers deal with policy, or should be. So some work is being done, but we have to examine what is being said and look at what happened last year, vis-a-vis what was in last year's budget. That's an important comparison to be made. Quite frankly, Madam Speaker, the first thing which struck everyone with earth-shattering skepticism was the sheer enormity of the grandiose investment plan contained in this budget. I mean, this must be a 20-year plan or something. I can't believe this is 1 or 5 years or, I mean, you know, the term of this administration. In terms of scale, capital requirements, and just about any other measure, it invokes considerable skepticism. You have to accept that. And it's not skepticism based on a political bias. It's skepticism based on reality. I wish I didn't have to say what I am saying here today. But I believe that if I don't do that, I will be aiding and abetting something which is not good for the people of this country. But I don't want you all to say that's right. That's my business. Stay out of this one. Let me deal with that. I mean, this thing is so, has so much skepticism in it that it's almost to the point of derision on the part of members opposite. And I'm watching, I mean, the men I contested elections with sitting there taking blows on this thing. One after the other. Because we fed the opposition with everything they needed to whack us on the head. I mean, what's this? And then, of course, it's being presented as Sir John's vision. But that's not how Sir John did things. I know Sir John. Anyway, this budget is all things to all sectors. There's something in there for every, I mean, things just in there, like you wouldn't believe. Why Sir John, as a representative of a rural community, understood the value of agriculture while not ignoring the importance of the new thrust in services. He was always meticulous about capital investment and foreign investment, preferring an incremental approach to avoid overheating our economy. Economies can overheat, you know. It's like a car. You push it too fast, you know, you blow a gasket. And the maintenance of prudent debt-to-GDP ratios. That was important to Sir John. Anybody who knows that knows Sir John has said that St. Lucia would never get into the clutches of the IMF as long as he was Prime Minister of St. Lucia. I mean, let's face the facts. Sir John was advanced in age when he got here. Somehow or the other, I believe Sir John understood that he was not a well man. He came when he read something. There were parts of it he believed in, parts of it he hoped he would be able to achieve, maybe over 20 years, because he said he will take us to the mountaintop, but he might not reach paradise with us. That's understandable, because Sir John liked to see good things for St. Lucia. And there are benefits, and there are problems with too much, too fast, as we all know. But Madam Speaker, I will speak on that matter further. But for now, let me say, at this particular juncture, that this budget has cast me into a serious conflict of loyalty. Loyalty to my party, loyalty to my colleagues, and loyalty to the truth, and what it is that confronts the people of St. Lucia today. Because what we have before us is a budget that flatters the whims and fanciful aspirations of a few well-connected and influential party honchos, but is barren and insensitive to the needs of the masses. The architect of this thing is a cold and unfeeling person. And I pity the Prime Minister for going out on a limb with this. And like me, there are those who are comfortable with dangling the lure of rapid economic growth before an unsuspecting public, who in many cases are not financially sophisticated enough to truly grasp the implications or the sophistication of this snake oil ruse. You know what snake oil is? In the old West, there used to have a fellow who would appear in a town in the morning, Madam Speaker, and stand up on a soapbox with a big box of little bottles, and he'd say that he has the cure for everything. So people would gather around him and he would show all the fancy stuff, and people would buy it. If you had a bellyache, that could cure it. Bad back, it could cure it. Anything wrong with you, you could cure it. The wonders of snake oil. Just like if you have 7 hotels, you can get it. 2 ports, we can get it. Maybe not. That's all we find, we can get everything. And when people go home the next day, when they realize that they've been had, The sick boy salesman is out of town with all the money. Snake oil. You know, over the last few weeks, a lot of public debate has taken place, you know. And people have gone around talking about ministry, what's next to even get ministry, and all this nonsense. And I see that it's not about being rewarded with a ministry. It's not about being upset because I'm not at the epicenter of decision making. It's not even about having to uphold and swallow the indignity of watching a government present a quadrant plan to selected businessmen in the country at a meeting up north. And I was never invited. I'm a member of parliament on the government side, present a quadrant plan, the whole plan of the country. I'm never even invited. Things for Chauzel, supposedly. And then I'm supposed to come here and support it. Especially when I don't believe in it. If I did, I'll hold my breath and support it. I'll hold my nose and support it. But when I look at this thing, I wonder what we're talking about. Because all of these people were there salivating at the prospects of big profits based on what they're seeing there in this budget. I know all the faithful will speak about me. Just vexed, as I said. They ain't give him nothing. In fact, Timothy Polion, the famous talk show host, said that it's about rewarding him with a ministry. Reward? Madam Speaker, I want to reward this country with my service for having given me the honor of sitting in this honorable house. I'm the one ready to reward. I'm not looking for a reward. But in all of that, let me tell you some of the things that matter to me. You know, when I see a lady, several in her 30s, some of them in their late 20s, making $600-$700 a month, 2-3 children in these times, and I know how hard they have it, I feel for them. When I meet the gentleman I saw who used to work for $1,600 a month, but he upset the wrong person and got fired, and then had to take a watchman job. 50-something years old, watchman job paying him $650 a month. 4 children to take care of, sent to school. And watch this man crying in front of me, saying, "Mr. Buske, try and help me, try and get something better for me. I can't make it." Emasculated in his house. But when you are as a man, when you walk into your home and you can't provide for your family, you've been emasculated. You're embarrassed. It causes all kinds of problems. Your wife ready to leave you and all that kind of stuff. So, Madam Speaker, it's about representing the interests of those people. Representing the interests of the small man. And not some hot talking, fast talking investor who has high priced, well connected lawyers who can get him a meeting with the Prime Minister even before his own cabinet members can get one. Or the slick accountants that come around and they manipulate the figures, because back in the 60s, Black America had a thing saying, "Boy, you can kill you with that pen." And they'll change things so they can make the desert of despair turn into a sunny land of milk and honey. For me, it's about representing the interests of the average citizen. No, Mr. Polio, it's not about rewarding me with the ministry. And I want to make one small diversion here before I get further into the meat of this budget. You know, people are invited to serve in a cabinet. You're hired. You don't always run around in solution with this silly underclass notion of being hired by a prime minister. Or hired by no prime minister, you've been invited to serve. At that level, this is what it is. It's a level where gentlemen meet, where your word means something, where you do what you say and you say what you do. That's a level of prime ministership. And if the relationship should deteriorate, or one would find oneself at odds with the prime minister, then you are invited to submit your resignation. While technically people may call it firing, but you are invited to submit your resignation. Because you invited the person to serve. You didn't hire them. The person didn't come here with an application and so on, and you hire them. So it's a severe repudiation of a cabinet member when the prime minister asks you to submit your resignation. But it is done with dignity and class. That's what that's about. But when you fire people, it is classless and vengeful, and not befitting of the high offices which we hold, or the final wishes of a man about to meet his maker. That's my point. Still waiting for my letter. Our speaker, irrational self-serving loyalties are all that stand between the will of the people and the vulgar, secular, political, and personal interests. Let me say that again. Irrational self-serving loyalties, let those with ears, let them hear, are all that stand between the will of the people and vulgar, secular, political, and personal interests. That's all. Honorable ministers must examine the collective consciences, and decide for how long they will allow this situation to continue. How long? What is it? People are afraid they get fired. You can't fire nobody again. You know, bring down the government. Who are you going to fire again? You know? I told the Prime Minister some time ago, because I was told by somebody that the Prime Minister didn't want to bring me in because he was afraid of looking weak. But I said, sometimes you can look weak and be strong. And there are times when you can look strong and be weak. So take your pick. Anyway, Madam Speaker, in continuing, I will refrain from the karaoke budget and borrow from the author, Nassim Nicholas Taleb, and his famous tale, The Black Swan, which speaks to the impact of the highly improbable. So perhaps this budget is a black swan. I don't know if anybody ever seen one. But I haven't. But I do know one thing. Leadership is about releasing human energy. Because we can only do so much as individuals. But moving and motivating people, be clear about what we want to do. What is the vision? Not runaway construction and steel and concrete and all of that. I want to support good things for solution. But I must have confidence in where I am being taken. Based on what's going on globally, I can't have confidence in the proposals being outlined. There are obviously far greater priorities, Madam Speaker, in my view, pressing on the collective needs of this nation. The public debt has grown by 8.4% to $1,764.4 million. And payables, though lower, stand at $13.9 million for a total of $1,774.4 million. This represents 67.9% of GDP, which is above the prudent guidelines set by the ECCD of 60% of GDP. While most of this debt was not accumulated under this administration, but nonetheless, we knew it was there. And we won elections by promising we will do something about it. But in spite of discussions indicating that we're going to save, what, $300 million in recurrent expenditure? I see that we're adding to the debt load. I heard the Minister of Communications at an interview that he was having state that we must increase growth in order to have the money to pay down debt. But does not this level of private sector investment require a substantial component of public sector debt to provide the infrastructure necessary to support the investment? If not, why then are we borrowing over $200 million? But we have to be careful when we talk about putting down infrastructure, especially when it's being put down at a rate that is intended to accommodate unrealistic investment. I'll give you an example. A lot of investment was made for Cricket World Cup. Everybody thought St. Lucia would run out of food, run out of hotel places, run out of all kinds of things. But what happened? It didn't happen. So, if we knew it wasn't going to happen, perhaps the government might have scaled back on its public investment program. So we got to be careful. You can go and borrow money to do all kinds of wild stuff, preparing for investment that never comes. And then you put the country in a bigger mess. No, this cannot be Sir John's vision. Not the Sir John I knew all my life, all my life. I didn't get to know him like some people. I knew him all my life. And I had the honor and the pleasure of working with him. Yeah, we had our rows, our spats, because, you know, Sir John didn't like fellas who would stand up and tell him what it is. Simple as that. He liked you to make sense, you know, and he didn't mind you telling him something, but if you push it too far, at some point you were supposed to realize who's boss and just shut up. Well, maybe I was a little too bold for my own good. But then once I start, no point stopping now. Slow and steady. Low debt. And a prudent, sustainable ratio of public to private sector investment in order to ensure sustainable growth over an extended period. That was Sir John's way. Madam Speaker, this PM has regurgitated the grand plans of others who have failed in their personal lives, which were filled with grand plans. Their history is a litany of failed grand plans. Groundbreaking ceremonies for hotels that never came up. I remember seeing, who is it, Dr. Vaughan Lewis as Prime Minister, Mikey Pilgrim and a few others on the front page of The Voice, turning the sod for a hotel. I don't forget anything, you know. Up to now, not one block in the ground. All sorts of ventures. Nothing. But today, with the public purse, I heard the leader of the opposition talk about vehicle upon vehicle. Grand offices befitting of a pharaoh in the drywall building. Anybody who doubts me, go there. At public expense. Whereas the little lady in Saltibus is getting $85 a month to support herself. And those with a husband get $120. That's what bothers me. That's what bothers the hell out of me. And I have a responsibility, Madam Speaker, to stand in this house and say it is a duty, a sacred duty and a responsibility to change that now. We must stop this foolishness. Otherwise, we don't deserve to go to bed at night and sleep peacefully. What happens to these people, man? I meet them all the time, Mr. Buzka, tell them put a little something on it for us. $85 for somebody in this day and age? My God, man. And that's not a priority? $120 for a couple? And that's not a priority? how we treat our elderly and impoverished people is a stellar exhibition of the conscience of a nation. No. I'm sorry. I won't be part of that. Because there are a lot of people out there who are ready to make a quick profit. They were nowhere around during the campaign, but strategically put on a yellow suit when they felt the time was right and just appeared on the scene. And next thing I know, they're calling all the shots. Can't be right. And while they're calling all the shots, I can tell you one thing. Members from this side of the house are the ones who are going to be responsible to the people. We are the ones who are going to have to answer. At the end of the day, all of these people head home to their wives and their children. But we, I heard the member for Castries Central talking about an SUV, or not an SUV, some motion or a bill to provide duty-free vehicles from the MPs. I don't even made one mistake. It should be for elected members, not MPs. Because elected members are the ones who have to use their vehicle as a taxi, as an ambulance, everything when you're down in these rural communities. You're the ones who have to do it. The members sitting here in this honorable house. So a fellow becomes a senator, he's an MP, you give him a vehicle, a year later you have to fire him, you have a duty-free vehicle. What nonsense is that? Elected members. Vehicles for elected members. But members sitting here, I deliberately put you all on the spot today, Madam Speaker. I put them on the spot. Because they can't say they didn't know or they didn't hear. They now have to face their people. Some of whom like me, or I know people say I'm arrogant or whatever the case may be. I don't think I'm arrogant. I represent people in Shozelle. Or you walk into rooms and see children in rooms where there's no flooring and the mud and be arrogant. How do you walk into houses where people are so poor, the smell is nauseating, but you're in there smiling and doing whatever you can and be arrogant? I live at Rodney Heights, but I'm not Rodney Heights. I'm Shozelle. That's where I belong. And that's where I'm going to do my service to country, my service to God, my service to my people. But I can't help them there without first helping them here. This is where it starts. So anybody who went into politics for a good time, I know you've been fooled. Because there ain't no good time in this. This is work, hard work, and sacrifice. That's what it's about. There are a lot of people out there who think it's a jolly thing. Yeah, you got a little books. For fellows who never knew what a dinner was at Coal Pot before they won an election. Because some investor is now bringing them by Coal Pot for the first time and they're so impressed that they're allowing themselves to be bought cheap. That's their problem. But I went there before. So I know what it is. So when you come talk to me, you've got to come good. Because I'm not here for your interest, I'm here for the interest of my people. And you can't bluff me, because I know what the game is all about. Madam Speaker, I really don't believe, with all credit to the Prime Minister, but based on the fact that he came with this budget, that he really understands exactly what he is proposing vis-a-vis the headwinds which we are facing at this time. This is arguably the most challenging economic period since the Great Depression. That's how bad it is. It's not easy. And Madam Speaker, I will speak now about, first of all, the global situation. The IMF in January reported global growth, projected global growth. The IMF in January projected global growth of 4.18%. Then by April of this year, they had revised that growth downward to 3.7%. That was a very quick downward revision. And I personally expect that before it's all over, there will be further downward revisions in terms of global growth. The world slowing down, but we speeding up. St. Lucia, 0.5 to 7. I don't know. Skepticism. It's warranted. It's warranted. Everybody talks about us living in an increasingly interconnected world. That's true. And therefore, this is a truly defining moment in the life of St. Lucia. This budget is not just important, but critical. This is where our future starts, right here and now. Remember, no one can go back in life and make a brand new start. But you can start from where you are now and make a brand new ending. Let's make that brand new ending. Because I will move on to tell you that we must begin with the end in mind. Whenever you take an action, unless you're a fool, you should predict what the end result will be. Will we be a suburb of the United States? Very few people seem to have noticed this, but I remember the minister for tourism on Timothy Polion's program on television once saying that St. Lucia will become a suburb of the United States. Are we going to become a suburb of the United States? Or are we going to become a thriving independent state within a union of the Caribbean or some other like-minded geographic an economic block? In case no one has informed the Prime Minister, there is a global financial crisis which has yet to be fully quantified. Bankers, financial analysts, and every conceivable commentator with a pulse have weighed in on this situation, and estimates range from $350 billion to $1 trillion in toxic mortgage-backed securities. These mortgage-backed securities were packaged and sold all over the world, and many of them are going bad. There's also the consideration that there's a further $1 trillion worth of derivatives which are floating out there in the financial world and are essentially worth pennies on the dollar. This is a global crisis affecting both commercial banks and investment banks, hedge funds and private equity companies. Banks have been told to shore up their capital base and are busy diluting shareholder equity in order to raise capital. They're selling all divisions, profitable divisions, doing whatever is necessary. In fact, you might know that there was a run on a UK bank some months ago where depositors were running to the bank to try and get their money and couldn't get it. Bank refused to give you the money because they had none. Serious situation. The Bank of England, the European Development Bank, the European Central Bank, and the Federal Reserve in the United States are all taking all sorts of action to inject liquidity into the financial sector. In fact, the Federal Reserve has gone as far as opening what they call a discount window to allow banks to borrow money. And they have moved from allowing not only commercial banks, but also investment banks to do this. In spite of this, banks are not lending. They're holding on to the money to shore up the capital base. And credit has become very tight globally. Credit standards have increased globally to the point where it's extremely difficult to get credit. Credit for commercial ventures and even private ventures. The United States, our major partner, is undergoing a serious housing crisis. This housing crisis has resulted in certain states, especially the hot states like Miami, Las Vegas, California, where prices have dropped 30-40%. People are losing their homes. In the financial sector alone, in New York and in London, 50,000 people have lost their jobs in that sector, and counting. This is a global financial crisis of great significance. The Federal Reserve in the United States has been forced to continuously cut interest rates in order to spur economic growth. But in so doing, they have devalued the US dollar, and it has resulted in a situation where commodity prices are going out of this world. Inflation is going up. In fact, we're in a situation potentially where there could be deflation. That is, you're getting inflation and yet your economy is contracting. These situations happen. And it's a situation where most economists expect that if you cut interest rates, you will get inflation, but you'll get more economic activity. But if economic activity declines, like having a recession, then demand for goods and services will also decline, so there will be more available and prices will drop. It's not happening yet. Oil running all over the place. Yesterday it hit $119.48. I was told today it's $117 a barrel. As far as commodities go, because oil is not just bought like this, oil is traded on the futures market. The futures traders are confident that there is no apparent situation in which oil is likely to go below $100 a barrel in the foreseeable future. These are the things we're facing. That vibrant consumer you used to see was because of what they call the housing ATM. People would buy a home, next year it's worth 20% more. So if you buy it for $100,000, it's worth $120,000. So you can now go to the bank and borrow $20,000 on it at low interest rates. So people had money to spend. People don't have that money now because the house is losing value. We've seen the collapse of Bear Stearns, a company that a year ago was worth $150 a share. It was sold to J.P. Morgan Chase for $2 a share. Serious stuff. Collapse of a marquee investment bank. We're not talking about some little sloppy bank. We're talking about a serious bank. These are the headwinds we're facing. Madam Speaker, this is the wrong time for financial adventurism. Wrong time. Let me touch now, Madam Speaker, briefly on the global food crisis, something which many members opposite have spoken about. Today, there was a report which stated that the UN food program is feeding 100 million more people around the world, 100 million more people this month as opposed to last month. Can you believe that? 100 million more people are being fed in 1 month. Rice, up 60% in 1 year. Wheat, soybeans, and corn, up 66%. 30-year lows in terms of supplies of grain in the many storage vats around the world. 30-year low. Never been that low since the 1970s. Riots in Haiti, Bangladesh, and Egypt. People fighting for bread. Have to stay in line from 2 o'clock in the morning until 8 o'clock in the night to try and get a little piece of bread. You all think it can never happen here? Well, do nonsense and find out. There's been a lack of production of agricultural produce in many developing countries where they need it most, because fertilizer and genetically produced seeds are too expensive. So the poorer people, instead of actually growing more food, are growing less food. There's drought and fungus, unprecedented, and with the global warming situation that is currently at our doorsteps, it's likely to get worse. These are the situations that we're facing. Are we preparing for that? No. You want to go and build a tunnel. That's all you want to do. Airports. You know, I thought about that airport thing and it made no sense. Let me tell you why. We have two airports. We've been told that GFL Charles will be increased in length and all sorts of things to accommodate 767s. I think I'm correct in terms of the designation. Is it 737? Yes. Which is the most widely used aircraft in most fleets. But if you're going to build an airport and extend it to get the most widely used jet to go to Huanora, why are you then spending a whole bunch of money on Beaufort? I mean, does that make sense? Does that make sense to me? It doesn't make sense to me. I mean, you want me to come here and lie? No. You see, maybe if I was there and somebody had asked me a question before they came with the budget, then I could have spotted these things. There's a price to pay, you know. All right. As I said, my last speaker, there's a lack of production in poorer countries because of a lack of food, seeds, genetically engineered seeds and fertilizers. As the member for Caspi's East pointed out, that Sam's Club in the United States today put a rationing on rice. Each consumer could only buy 4 bags of 2-pound rice. That's the maximum you can buy. That's in the United States. Ethanol, which is being used now to produce, corn, which is being used to produce ethanol, has been considered a gigantic policy mistake because it's really causing a problem. Less corn, it goes, the price goes up.
Panel member, you have 10 more minutes within which to complete the presentation. Member for Cassidy, I would say I recognize your need. You're going to member for Gamino.
Madam Speaker, I beg to invoke the provision of standing order 42.10 to allow the member from Swazelle an additional 30 minutes within which to complete his presentation.
Honourable members, the question is that standing order 32.10 be invoked to allow the member for Swazelle an additional 30 minutes within which to complete his presentation. I now put the question, as many as have the opinion say aye, as many as have the contrary opinion say no. I think the ayes have it. The ayes have it. Leader Swazelle.
Thank you, Madam Speaker. Thank you, Honourable Members, for this very kind concession on your part. In Zimbabwe, Madam Speaker, Mugabe country, there's no lot of talk about that now. I saw a sign on television, a fellow had a poster. Starving billionaire. That's what he had on it. Because he was worth $1 billion, but he was starving. So he had starving billionaire. You know why? Because I think they recently produced a $100,000 bill. And if you go and buy a loaf of bread, you're paying about $200,000 for it. So he's a billionaire, but starving. Think it can't happen here? Huh. Better be careful. Madam Speaker, Dominic Strauss-Kahn, the managing director of the IMF, said that high food prices are a global humanitarian disaster at this point. There are demands from what's called the BRIC nations. These are all the emerging economies in the world. Brazil, Russia, India, China. BRIC. These are countries with unusual growth rates at this particular point in time. Tremendous economic activity taking place there. And of course, with that kind of activity, people have more disposable income. So they want to eat better food. So they're also screening the food demands of the world. Saudi Arabia, as I said before, is an exporter of wheat. But it is projected that by 2011, they will become a net importer of wheat. I mean, people thought it was only oil. So there are demands out there. There are countries that are demanding this stuff, and we need to prepare, and to prepare now. Madam Speaker, it's time to tighten our belts and engage in harnessing the energies of our people, especially in the areas of food production for domestic consumption and, wherever possible, export. Wrong time for financial adventurism. Because I really believe, Madam Speaker, that if we start looking at these other programs, it will distract the government. If we're pouring our energies into all this sort of thing, we'll miss something. And what we miss might bring an unretrievable situation to the people of this country. Madam Speaker, on the question of commodities, let me move further with respect to oil. I just want to touch on this one very quickly. As we know, oil keeps going up and goes down a bit, but it goes back up. In fact, it shot up recently because Russia announced that they would be cutting production by 1%. Nigeria is always in some kind of little guerrilla war, and fellas are blowing up oil pipelines and so on and creating problems. Every time something blows up, we have a problem. The serious thing, though, is that we have not reached the summer driving season in the United States, which is the peak. And usually prices go up at that particular point in time. In addition, we also haven't hit the hurricane season. Because you know what happens when there's a hurricane or some hurricane hits the southeast United States. We have major problems, especially with oil, because many of the biggest refineries are on the southeastern coast. There's demand for steel, cement, everything. Huge demand, prices going up. Consumer sentiment is now low. And on that basis, let me talk a little bit about the refinery. I think I remember the Prime Minister saying that it is not the place of this government to announce the arrival of any refinery. It's not the place of the government. Okay. But I'll tell you what I know about refineries at this particular point in time. In the U.S., there are three major refining companies. Valero, Tesoro, Sunoco. Valero is the biggest. Because of the high prices of oil, it is squeezing the margins because they can't raise the price of the finished product as quickly as the price of the fuel, which is the oil, which is the raw material, as high as that's going up, as quickly as that's going up. A lot of them have actually cut back on capacity utilization in order to do repairs, you know, maintenance and things of that nature at this particular point in time. The other reality is that refineries cost a lot of money. Very technical, take a lot of time to build. And because of the shortages, a number of countries have already engaged years ago in commencing to put refineries on the ground. And so, it seems to me, and I could be wrong, I mean, you know, I don't know what businessmen will do, but it seems to me somewhat unlikely that a company will invest in a refinery for the simple reason that I think they'll be somewhat late to the party. Because there are a number of refineries coming on stream in the world. Yes, there was a shortage of refineries or refining capacity, but there are a number of refineries coming on stream within the next few years. And so I see a situation where there can be overproduction. Now, Hess Oil as a company is doing very well. Shares shooting up all over the place, making money. But I don't see them taking that kind of gamble at this particular point in time. But what's most important to me is how inconsistent the refinery is with all of this investment in tourism. I mean, I remember 10 years ago, a little over 10 years ago, there was an oil spill. Very few people remember that. There was an oil spill between Martinique and St. Lucia. And oil was reaching all down here. Is this really consistent with what we want to do in terms of our beauty and our environmental? Situation? I don't know. Madam Speaker, all of that is the backdrop against which we are proposing this development plan. These are the headwinds against which the ship of state must sail. This is no time for economic adventures, but for solidification. As one international leader recently said to his people, I may not achieve outlandish prosperity, but I will prevent disaster by ensuring that my policies are in keeping with the urgent realities with which I am now confronted. I wish I'd heard that from my Prime Minister. I wish I had been able to suggest he say that. I believe it would have rung a note with the people of this country, and it would have given them confidence that the situation was well enough. But there's an obsession with growth and grand misadventures. That miss thing would probably ring the bell here. And the common thread that runs through particular individuals in the government and the influence on the lives of our people is unacceptably high. It's much too high. It is disproportionate to the point of being dangerous. And honorable members must take a stand. Must take a stand. I hear about the Prime Minister's constitutional authority. He can hire, he can fire, a lot of people say he can do what he wants. But his decisions must make sense. That is the critical thing. Because that's where it's judged. Does it make sense? Is it valuable? Is it what we need? Because in this day and age, everything you do is under scrutiny. And your decisions must make sense. And if they don't, you're going to have to examine him. Because what standards are we holding ourselves to when people are out there in the public saying that that is the prime minister and fire we want? You can't walk into a job, any citizen in this country, and the prime minister, the owner of the company just gets up and fires you. I mean, nobody would think that's right. So we have to hold ourselves. Sometimes they say we must hold ourselves to a higher standard. But I think when it comes to common decency, the standard is fairly universal. Madam Speaker, massive economic growth has many unintended consequences.
Honourable Member for Wilford North, you have a point of order.
Madam Speaker, on a point of order. I have listened to the arguments about hiring and firing and about the national constitution, and I believe that it would be amiss of me.
I remember, what is the point of order exactly? Has the member misquoted something?
I would like to read the constitution where it clearly states the right of the prime minister to hire and fire.
Are you saying that the member has misquoted the constitution? Is that what you're saying?
I'm saying that he's misconstruing the information.
Well, to misconstrue, I would think, is not a point of order. Two people can read a document and have different interpretations of that document. It would be a point of order if you are saying that the member quoted or misquoted the Constitution, but as to what it means, persons can have different opinions as to what the same words mean. So that would not be a point of order.
The member questioned there earlier on in his conversation, Madam Speaker, stated he had not received a letter. But in the Constitution, it does not require a letter be sent to you for your firing.
That again, I would say, is not a point of order. The member said he had not received a letter. If you have information that the member did receive a letter and what he's saying is inaccurate or misleading, that would be a point of order. So you really have to deal with the point of order is not the interpretation, but what it is, the member said, that would be an issue. Please continue.
Thank you, Madam Speaker. I suppose I was perhaps in that position many, many years ago when I first sat in this Honorable House. So this is all excusable. But what I will say, Madam Speaker, is that there are many unintended consequences. But if the past year is any guide, we have every right to be skeptical about this government's ability to implement this program. I know that in the last budget there was talk of IT parks, beginnings of tunnels and things of that nature, but the reality has been much different. Capital expenditure declined by 22.2% to 218.5 million, or 8.5% of GDP, after consecutive increases in previous years. Very few new projects were started due to the unavailability of funds. This is all contained within the Economic and Social Review. Madam Speaker, how much time do I have left, Madam Speaker? I wanted to...
You have 25 minutes left.
Thank you. All of this development, Madam Speaker, has been the responsibility of one minister in particular. And now we are expected to deal with the reality of that and other projects. Let us look at the Castries port development, for example, because I'm talking about reality versus what you see on paper. I know that companies like Carnival, for example, all of these big multinationals, public companies trading on the New York Stock Exchange and the NASDAQ, these people want to hoard all the money they can from these little islands. So when they come in, they want to buy, in some cases they have bought a whole island. So when they stop, all the shops there, the restaurants, everything, they own it. So they can keep the profits for themselves. When you hear about Castries Port Development, you think this is a vendor that's fighting with IPA right now to get a spot? Who's going to find herself inside there? All this massive port development that you're talking about is a way of ensuring that these developments are such that these companies will put in their own shops in many cases and ensure that they keep the profits circulating within the confines of the company and on its books. So while we will close down port Castries to containers, and I'm not saying it's bad, but I believe this thing has to be looked at very, very carefully, because we have to understand the consequences of that. Why we close down port Castries? Because there's a big new port coming down in Beaufort. And we get these containers from down there. And we have to now barge them with increasing high fuel prices. The end product is sure to be more expensive. So we, as the consumers in St. Lucia, are being asked to pay more for goods, as expensive as they already are. And what's the trade-off? If the Minister of Finance can tell me that these companies will in some form or the other subsidize the increased cost, then I wouldn't have a problem with it. But why put that on the backs of the average solution? Personally, I don't believe all these mega yacht things and so on are working. I mean, you might get one or two or three. I'm not saying nothing will happen. But we've got a lot of work to do in terms of branding before that becomes a reality. Because people with 250-foot yachts and so on, they're going to Monaco. They're going to the south of France. I'm not saying they won't come here. They might base something here and rent it out. Make money going down to the Grenadines. I used to pass the one going down to Beaufort. I used to see a number of jets parked at Eunora. And I used to say, boy, some serious people with money coming down here to do business. Then somebody disabused me of that. They said, these people come here, they park their jet, they get on a little plane and go down to Mustique or the Grenadines or something. So if we make a little money on the thing, on landing fees or something, I think that's about where it ends. So we got to be careful. And when we make these investments, we've got to maximize the return to the solution. Maximize it. I'm going to have to move on because I don't have a lot of time. Here are the harsh realities facing solutions, Madam Speaker. I spoke about the poverty, the paupers list, and so on, which I think is important. But I think in terms of healthcare, I mean the amount of people who need healthcare and they can't get it, can't afford it, that something must be done with this national insurance plan. This is critical. We have to do that to take care of our people. We've got to find the money somewhere. I mean, we can find $50 million for marketing with declining results. I mean, we need to find that. We need to understand that real wages are declining. The real wages to the people, even if people get a raise of 5%, when inflation is 10%, the buying power of your money has gone down. So even if you have more money, you're buying less with it. We have to understand these realities and understand the plight of the common man, the average solution. And when we're talking about $50 million here and $50 million there, one 90,000 SUV would give an extra $80 a month to 1,000 people. That's the kind of thing I'm talking about. So what are we doing? Where's our conscience? Are we going to sit here and allow these things to happen? The country will judge us harshly for that. Harshly for that sort of thing. Construction. You hear about all the big projects. Remember a few years ago, you couldn't get cement? You waited weeks and weeks, you're looking for cement, you have a little project, all everybody on Gosu, no cement. Even now, sometimes there are cement shortages. You think when you want to buy a little 10,000 bags of cement, China bringing in 1 million bags an hour, you think the company has any time for you with your little requirements? I mean, all these things are higher. You want to build a house now? I'll never build a house now. I'll wait. Hopefully the world will slow down enough for prices to come back down. You can't get plumbers. You can't get workers. So when we go with all these big projects, what are we going to do? I understand there are workers from all over the world down at Paradi. People from Israel working. And if we didn't make a change, contrary to the feelings of members opposite, doesn't matter how few Chinese there, do you? But the reality is that there's a poor general sentiment. There's a poor general sentiment amongst our people. I used to take little walks up north sometimes, and I used to walk past the landings and cross there and continue going. You can't do it anymore. The hotel has a marina there now. Cut you off. I mean, I'm not against the landings. I heard it's a lovely place and all this sort of thing, and I'm not against investment. But there's a price to pay. These are the prices that we pay. Those are the simple pleasures that Caribbean people are supposed to enjoy. This is what makes us unique. This is why people come here in the first place. No big rich people. You know, rich people go to Bora Bora. You know why? Because they want to live in a fast hut thing. You know, they go to DiCaprio. DiCaprio's place in Belize, where he bought 1,000 acres and has stuff on the beach there where you go and you can take out your clothes and lie down in a hot tub. But what they want is service. I don't know about this big thing. I want to deal with this, let me deal with some important issues quickly. Well, I move on from that one. That's important, but, you know, I want to talk about Wasco just a little bit because, you know, with all the development we're talking about, I heard the member for Nipu North expressing concern with respect to golf courses and the amount of water these things require and so on and so forth. I mean, do we know the real water situation in St. Lucia? I know, I don't get water at my house. Especially certain times a year, trucks got to bring water all the time and so on. I see trucks going to hotels and this and that and the other. I mean, we got to do a rapid infrastructure development program at a high cost in order to deal with that level of investment that we're talking about. How is that supposed to work? I mean, and we talk about the privatization of Wasco. I know the government is in a conundrum. It's difficult. I don't wish this problem on myself. But when you're talking about privatizing Wasco and saying a private company is going to take this and the private sector is going to take that, who's going to invest in Wasco? Unless you can raise prices and make it profitable. Who's going to invest in it? So when the Prime Minister in his address says that they will not raise prices in the first instance, well, that's right. Maybe they won't give them a raise before they invest. But I guarantee you they must give them a raise at some point. Because you don't invest money to lose money. You invest money to make money. And that's just a reality. Now, is it necessary? It may very well be. I am not saying that you shouldn't raise the prices to make the thing work. But what I'm saying is, tell the people so. How many hotels have succeeded in St. Lucia of a grand size? Mr. Good Steward is a very clever businessman, you know. What he does is he buys them after they fail. There's an old saying in the hotel industry, the first person to build a hotel loses money. There's a second and third buyer who will make money. Not the first. You build, or you're in trouble. Madam Speaker, growth as a dominant economic philosophy in this particular instance is trumping common sense. And what we need to look at is sustained incremental growth. There are a lot of people, from what I understand, buying land where some of the development is supposed to take place. That's worth checking. Because these things, you know, we need to be careful. Madam Speaker, the member for Castries East spoke about tourism And I wanted to just say a little something on it. Because there are some things I don't understand and I think I should express them here. I concur with much of what the member for Kashmir East had to say with respect to tourism. And I think that the facts that he presented are so impenetrable and solid that unless you bias or you just have a political bend, I don't see how you can possibly disregard it. But I am particularly concerned about the whole airline thing. I mean, I'm not saying don't invest, but the airline industry is in serious trouble with oil at the prices that it is today. We have seen the closure and bankruptcy of several airlines. I think as many as four or five airlines have gone out of business. Airlines are now starting to merge. Delta Airlines and United Airlines have merged to form the biggest airline in the world because they have to come together in order to solidify themselves for survival. Not for making big profits, but just to survive. United Airlines reported its quarterly results just yesterday. And there was a 70-something percent reduction in profits, in losses, year over year. The shares dropped almost 60%. This is what we're facing. So when we go there and talk about negotiating with that, I'm saying we've got to be careful. There's a gentleman, a consultant down here. I don't know the gentleman. He may be a nice gentleman doing a lot of work, a Mr. Heppel, making $150,000 a month. Have we given poor people $80 or $85? I mean, what's he doing? I don't know what he's doing. If he's doing something, I would like to know. Why are we being burdened with this? What is this all about? Who is this gentleman? What's his contribution? One of the first things I thought when the current Minister of Tourism was appointed was that he had the expertise. Been in the business a long time. So what is the need to hire all these experts? And as far as that appointment is concerned, my own speaker, let me just say, I remember when Mr. Craig Barnard was considered for the chairmanship of the St. Lucia Tourist Board. And there was this big hue and cry about conflict of interest. How could Craig Barnard be chairman of the Tourist Board when he has a hotel? But the minister now has a hotel. The minister. There's no conflict of interest there. I mean, what are we talking about here? Now, I know they're coming for me. I know they're coming for me. But the truth shall set you free. And I think St. Lucians have forgiven me already. My indiscretions and infelicities. I mean, I heard the Minister of Tourism on television speaking about you need another $50 million this year. It's going to cost us more than 50 because 10 is coming out of revenue and 40 million is coming out of bonds. You have to pay interest on those bonds. So it's more than $50 million if you consider the interest you pay on the life of the bond. $250 million, a quarter of $1 billion he's expected to get in the 5 years since, if he remains there. That's up to you all. Take a stand. And he said that he's hoping to have, well, right now it is going to be paid out of the hotel occupancy tax. Those were his words. But if we give it a few years, there'll be so many more tourists that the financing gap, which is going to come out of public funds, it will be closed by virtue of the money which the additional visitors will pay in hotel occupancy tax. So effectively, it will be self-funding. $50 million. I'm not saying he shouldn't get $50 million. Where is his plan? Has he submitted a plan on how this is being spent? If I, as a minister, had to travel from Castries to Rat Island, I had to submit something to the Ministry of Finance to get approval to go on the canoe. If they have to pay the canoe, the Prime Minister has to approve it. This minister travels where he wants, when he wants, no approval, no nothing. What? How is that happening? So they have special ministers then. mean, I know I'm not going to get no free tickets to Jazz Festival. But, you know, I'll sit on the grass with the people. You know, because I like it there. Rather than going and stand in some grandstand with all the big boys. Because I know they have no respect for you. They're only looking at you because you're a minister. And they're looking for what they can get from you. The day you don't win an election, go and talk to them. You'll see what happens. Go and see. But when they don't talk to you now, then you're going down to Sozelle and looking for comfort among the common man and woman in this country. That's why I will not forget them. I'll go and eat my jaw and my black pudding down in Sozelle instead. Bajan, sweet potatoes, and peanuts. Never run out of peanuts. Useful. So what are we going to do about this? Social scientists have long posited that you cannot solve a problem at the same level of thinking at which you created it. Cannot. Impossible. So what are we doing? The same things that got us into the position that we're in now, we're doing it. So we're solving the problem. There are important things that we must do, Madam Speaker, in order to proceed. First of all, we have to harness the strength of all the people in this country. This tribalism must stop. I've heard it and I support it. The Prime Minister, after I was no longer Minister of Foreign Affairs, and he became Minister of Foreign Affairs, never consulted with me to say, what were you doing? What's happening? What were we working on? Nothing. So, Mr. Leader of the Opposition, why should the Leader of the Opposition feel bad that he hasn't met and spoken to him? I was a minister, never spoke to me. Months went by, I never spoke to the Prime Minister. And I know that he lost a lot of stuff because of the failure to communicate. Stuff that would have been beneficial to the St. Lucian people. Because I was working, and there are a number of loose ends that were never tied up. We've got to stop this. We need every St. Lucian on board. We need to work with the opposition, work with the trade unions. We've got to trust our people, man. Let me tell you, Madam Speaker, when you go to people in a country and you say to them, look, this is what we're trying to do. We are working in your interest. This is what we're doing. Don't matter that the wall in the office is busted. We don't need to spend $500,000 to fix that wall. Let the wall stay that way for a year because we want to consolidate the country. And if people believe in you, they will suffer that wall being bad. They'll suffer the air conditioning not working. They'll suffer long lines. They'll work with you. But when they feel everybody running around in an SUV and all this kind of thing, and you want me to suffer, it's not going to happen. We've got to work from an egalitarian point of view. Collective work on responsibility. Collective decision making. And the priority of the person and the centrality of our St. Lucian community. That is what it's all about. When we do that, we'll see a different country. Because the people will start to respond in kind. So all the people you see now saying, boy, I want mine. They're going to start saying, you know what? Let me get like Kennedy. Let me see what I can do for my country instead of what my country can do for me. That is the critical dimension that we have to introduce in the social fabric of this country. It's up to you all. Sit there and play games. History will deal with you. We need to do a lot of cost cutting. Create greater efficiencies in government. I agree with the minister, the member for Cash Free Central. Cut out all these ministers in SUVs. Create a bad in government SUVs. It creates a bad impression. But give every elected member a duty-free vehicle. Allow him to purchase a duty-free vehicle on his own. I mean, we give it to the church. We give it to diplomats. We give it to foreign returning residents. I mean, you, the people of the country, you work for the country. So it's like your employer charging you tax, you know. Whereas employers here give people a vehicle. You come and work for my company, I give you a vehicle. You use your vehicle. You have to drive all over the place, countryside. I found a fellow 1 o'clock in the morning in my constituency walking down the road bleeding. I had to throw him in my car, bled all over the place, took him to the hospital, waited for him, paid for it, and took him back at his home. That's the kind of stuff that we do. So what's wrong with that? I support it. Let us show people that we are cutting corners, that we are doing something, and they will follow in kind. Madam Speaker, can I ask you to let me know when I have 5 more minutes?
You have 5 more minutes, I remember.
Thank you, Madam Speaker. We have to start using hedging strategies in terms of fuel costs. I can't expound on that, but there are hedging strategies to safeguard you against unusual spirals in the price of oil. We have to look at captive insurance, investigate the cost-benefit ratio of moving into capital captive insurance of government stock, of its hard assets. We need to look at these, investigate them all as possibilities for saving money, which we can then use for the benefit of our people. We have to revisit the fiscal incentives program, because you notice people don't build hotels anymore. They get a little hotel and they're going to build 300 condos. They sell them for $1.5, $2 million a piece. They make a huge profit and they leave. I don't mind giving you fiscal incentives. I'm not against fiscal incentives. You've got to attract people. Then you come in here and you invest $10 million and you make $90 million. Man, leave something here. So we'll just give you 10 years tax-free and all this sort of thing. We've got to cut that out. Hey, Madam Speaker, before I close, I just want to make two statements. One is going to be relating to my constituents. I want to thank my constituents for the tremendous support that you all have given me, standing with me, being with me in these difficult times. You're not doing it because I'm giving my constituents anything. They're doing it because they believe in me, because they love me, and I love them back with equal measure. I want to continue to ask them to bear with me. I will try my very best for them and do whatever I can in their interests. I want to thank the Minister of Communications and Works for assisting in completing the road up to industry. It was very important. We had to break a few, you know, fingers to get it done, but it's done and we're very, very grateful for it. And there are other things that we're going to be even more grateful for down the years. But I'm certainly hoping that the Monjak to Diga Road gets attention. The people in Daba, Park Gayabwa, all of these places, Gayabwa, Park Estate, major agricultural area, I don't see it on the list. You know, all of these things need to be spoken about, no time. But let me say this, Madam Speaker. I have one thing that I would like to be noted. There are things that I plan to do this year that hopefully I'll get the support to get them done. I can't go into detail, but I think, like the member for Castries East, my people believe in me and they know that I'll work in their interest. I've been distracted and I must apologize for my distractions at this particular point in time. But in this new financial year, I intend to change that and to get a number of things done in a big way. Finally, those who understand what I have said today need no further explanation. No further explanation is necessary. To those who do not understand, no clarification is possible. I thank you, Madam Speaker.